fair to the state. Freeman now had no opportunity to question Aparicio. "I'm going to strike his entire testimony," Perry declared. "I'll tell the jury not to consider it." Freeman folded her arms across her chest and shook her head in frustration. "That's a hell of a big bell to unring," she said. "This is a disaster for the prosecution, Judge. It's completely unfair." I said nothing, because Freeman was right. The judge could tell the jurors not to consider anything Aparicio had said, but it was too late. The message was delivered and was floating around in all their heads, just as I had intended. "Sadly, I see no alternative," Perry said. "We'll take lunch now, and I'll be thinking further on the issue. I suggest you three do the same. If you come up with something else before one, I will certainly entertain it." No one said anything. It was hard to believe it had come to this. The end of the case in sight, and things falling, just as planned. "That means you can all leave now," Perry added. "I'll tell the deputy that Mr. Aparicio is relieved as a witness. He probably has the whole media throng in the hallway, waiting to devour him. And he probably blames you for that, Mr. Haller. You might want to steer clear of him while he's in the courthouse." "Yes, Your Honor." Perry picked up the phone to call the deputy as we headed toward the door. I followed Freeman out and down the hallway to the courtroom. I was expecting it, when she turned on me, with nothing but pure and piercing anger in her eyes. "Now I know, Haller."
"Now you know what?"
"Why you and Maggie will never get back together again." That put a pause in my step, and Aronson walked right into me from behind. Freeman turned back around and kept going.
"That was a low blow, Mickey," Aronson said.
I watched Freeman go through the door to the courtroom. "No," I said. "It wasn't." Chapter 51. My last witness was my trusty investigator. Dennis Cisco Wojciechowski took the witness stand after lunch, after the judge told the jurors that all of Louis Aparicio's testimony was stricken from the record. Cisco had to spell his last name twice for the clerk, but that was expected. He was indeed wearing the same shirt from the day before, but no jacket and no tie. The fluorescent lighting in the courtroom made the black ink chains that wrapped his biceps clearly visible through the stretched sleeves of the pale blue shirt. "I'm just going to call you Dennis, if that is okay," I said. "It will be easier on the court reporter." Polite laughter rolled through the courtroom.
"That's fine with me," the witness said.
"Okay, now, you work for me, handling investigations for the defense. Is that correct, Dennis?"
"Yes, that's what I do."
"And you worked extensively for the defense on the Mitchell Bondurant murder investigation, correct?"
"Correct. You could say that I piggybacked my investigation on the police investigation, checking to see if they missed anything, or maybe got something wrong."
"Did you work from investigative materials that were turned over to the defense by the prosecution?"
"Yes, I did."
"Included in that material was a list of license plate numbers, correct?"
"Yes. The garage at Westland National had a camera positioned over the drive-in entrance. Detectives Curlin and Longstreth studied the recording from the camera and wrote down the plate number of every car that entered the garage between 7 when the garage opened and 9 when it was determined that Mr. Bondurant was already dead. They then ran the plates through the law enforcement computer to see if any of the owners had criminal records or should be further investigated for other reasons."
"And were any further investigations generated from this list?"
"According to their investigative records, no."
"Now, Dennis, you mentioned you piggybacked on their investigation. Did you take this list and check these plate numbers out yourself?"
"I did, all 78 of them, as best I could without access to law enforcement computers."
"And did any merit further attention, or did you reach the same conclusion as Detectives Curlin and Longstreth?"
"Yes. One car merited more attention, in my opinion, and so I followed up on it."
I asked permission to give the witness a copy of the 78 license plate numbers. The judge allowed it. Sisko pulled his reading glasses out of his shirt pocket and put them on. Which license plate did you want to further check out?
WNUT-Z9.
Why were you interested in that one?
Because at the time I looked at this list, we were already far down the road in our other avenues of investigation. I knew that Louis Aparicio was part owner in a business called Wingnuts. I thought maybe there was a connection to the vehicle that carried that plate.
So what did you find out?
That the car was registered to Wingnuts, a courier service that is partially owned by Louis Aparicio.
And again, why was that worthy of attention?
Well, as I said, I had the benefit of time. Curlin and Longstreth put this list together on the day of the murder. They did not know all the key factors or individuals involved. I was looking at this several weeks down the road. And at that point, I knew that the victim, Mr. Bondurant, had sent an incendiary letter to Mr. Aparicio, and...
Freeman objected to his description of the letter, and the judge struck the word incendiary from the record. I then told Sisko to continue.
From our viewpoint, that letter cut Aparicio in as a person of interest, and so I was doing a lot of background work on him. I connected him through Wingnuts to a partner named Dominic Capelli. Capelli is known to law enforcement in New York as an associate of an organized crime family run by a man named Joey Giordano. Capelli has various connections to other unsavory...
Freeman objected again, and the judge sustained it. I put on my best show of frustration, acting as though both the judge and prosecutor were keeping the truth from the jury. Okay, let's go back to the list and what it means. What did it show occurred at the garage involving a car owned by Wingnuts?
It showed that the car entered the garage at 8:05.
At what time did it leave?
The exit camera showed it leaving at 8:50.
So this vehicle entered the garage before the murder and left after the murder. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
And the vehicle was owned by a company that was owned by a man with direct ties to organized crime. Is that also right?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Did you determine if there was a legitimate business reason for a vehicle belonging to Wingnuts to be in that garage?
Of course. The business is a courier service. It is used regularly by a loft to deliver documents to Westland National. But what was curious to me is why the car entered at 8:05 and then left before the bank even opened at 9.
I looked at Sisko for a long moment. My gut said I had gotten all I needed to get. There was still chicken on the bone, but sometimes you just have to push the plate away. Sometimes leaving the jury with a question is the best way to go. I have nothing further, I said. My direct examination had been very precise in scope to include only testimony about the license plates. This left Freeman little to work with on cross. However, she did score 1 point when she elicited from Sisko a reminder to the jury that Westland National only occupied 3 floors of a 10-story building. The courier from Wingnuts could have been going somewhere other than the bank, thus explaining his early arrival in the garage. I was sure that if there was a record of a courier delivery to an office in the building other than the bank, then she would produce it, or Aparicio's people would magically produce it for her, by the time she could put on rebuttal witnesses. After a half hour, Freeman threw in the towel and sat down. That was when the judge asked if I had another witness to call. No, Your Honor, I said. The defense rests. The judge dismissed the jury for the day and instructed them to be in the assembly room by 9 the next morning. Once they were gone, Perry set the stage for the end of the trial, asking the attorneys if they would have rebuttal witnesses. I said no. Freeman said she wanted to reserve the right to call rebuttal witnesses in the morning. Okay, then we will reserve the morning session for rebuttal, if there is any rebuttal, Perry said. Closing arguments will begin first thing after the lunch break, and each side will be limited to 1 hour. With any luck and no more surprises,
Our jury will go into deliberations by this time tomorrow.
Perry left the bench then, and I was left at the defense table with Aronson and Trammell. Lisa reached over and put her hand on top of mine.
That was brilliant, she said. The whole morning was brilliant. I think that the jurors finally get it as well. I was watching them. I think they know the truth.
I looked back at Trammell and then at Aronson, two different expressions on their faces. Thank you, Lisa. I guess it won't be long before we find out.
Chapter 52. In the morning, Andrea Freeman surprised me by not surprising me. She stood before the judge and said she had no rebuttal witnesses. She then rested the state's case. This gave me pause. I had come to court fully prepared to face at least one final tilt with her. Testimony explaining the Wingnut's car in the bank garage, or maybe Driscoll's supervisor putting the boots to him. Even a prosecution foreclosure expert to contradict Aronson's assertions. But nothing. She folded the tent. She was going with the blood. Whether I had robbed her of her bolero crescendo or not, she was going to make her stand on the one incontrovertible aspect of the entire trial. The blood. Judge Perry recessed court for the morning so the attorneys could work on their closing arguments, and he could retreat to chambers to work on the jury charge, the final set of instructions jurors would take with them into deliberations. I called Rojas and had him pick me up on Delano. I didn't want to go back to the office. Too many distractions. I told Rojas just to drive, and I spread my files and notes out in the back seat of the Lincoln. This was where I did my best thinking, my best prep work. At 1 o'clock sharp, court reconvened. Like everything else in the criminal justice system, closing arguments were tipped toward the state. The prosecution got to speak first and last. The defense got the middle. It looked to me like Freeman was going with the standard prosecutorial format. Build the house with the facts on the first swing, and then pull their emotional strings on the second. Block by block, she outlined the evidence against Lisa Trammell, seemingly leaving out nothing presented since the start of the trial. The discourse was dry, but cumulative. She covered means and motive, and she brought it all home with the blood. The hammer. The shoes. The uncontested DNA findings. I told you at the beginning of this trial that blood would tell the tale, she said. And here we are. You can discount everything else, but the blood evidence alone warrants a vote of guilty as charged. I am sure you will follow your conscience and do just that. She sat down, and then it was my turn. I stood in the opening in front of the jury box and addressed the 12 directly. But I wasn't alone in the well. As previously approved by the judge, I brought Manny out to stand with me. Dr. Shamiram Arslanian's erstwhile companion stood upright with the hammer attached to the crown of his head. His head snapped back at the unusual angle that would have been necessary if Lisa Trammell had struck the fatal blow. "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury," I began, "I've got good news. We should all be out of here and back to our normal lives by the end of the day. I appreciate your patience and your attentiveness during this trial. I appreciate your consideration of the evidence. I'm not going to take up a lot of time here because I want you to get home as soon as possible. Today should be easy. This is a quick one. This case comes down to what I call a 5-minute verdict. A case where reasonable doubt is so pervasive that a unanimous verdict will undoubtedly be reached on your very first ballot. From there, I highlighted the evidence the defense had brought forth and the contradictions and deficiencies in the state's case. I asked the unanswered questions. Why was the briefcase open? Why did the hammer go so long without being found? Why was Lisa Trammell's garage found unlocked? And why would someone who is clearly going to succeed in defending her foreclosure case lash out against Bondurant? It eventually brought me to the centerpiece of my closing, the mannequin. The demonstration by Dr. Arslanian alone puts the lie to the state's case.
Without considering another single part of the defense case, Manny here gives you reasonable doubt. We know from the injuries to the knees of the victim that he was standing when struck with the fatal blow. And if he was standing, then this is the only position that he could have been in for Lisa Trammell to have been the killer. Head back, face to the ceiling. Is that possible? You must ask yourself. Is that likely? What would make Mitchell Bondurant look up? What was he looking up at? I paused there, hand in one pocket, adopting a casual and confident pose. I checked their eyes. All 12 of them were locked in on the mannequin. I then reached up to the handle of the hammer and slowly pushed it up, until the plastic face came down to a normal level, and the handle stood out at a 90-degree angle, too high for Lisa Trammell to grasp. The answer, ladies and gentlemen, is that he wasn't looking up because Lisa Trammell didn't do this. Lisa Trammell was driving home with her coffee while someone else carried out the plan to eliminate the threat that Mitchell Bondurant had become. Another pause to let it sink in. Mitchell Bondurant had poked the sleeping tiger with his letter to Louis Aparicio. Whether intended or not, the letter was a threat to the two things that give the tiger its strength and fierceness, money and power. It threatened a deal that was bigger than Louis Aparicio and Mitchell Bondurant. It threatened commerce, and therefore, it had to be dealt with. And it was. Lisa Trammell was chosen as the fall guy. She was known to the perpetrators of this crime. Her movements had been monitored by them, and she came with what appeared to be a credible motive. She was the perfect patsy. No one would believe her when she said, "I didn't do this." No one would give it a second thought. A plan was set in motion and carried out brazenly and efficiently. Mitchell Bondurant was left dead on the concrete floor of a garage, his briefcase pilfered on the floor right next to him, and the police showed up and went right along for the ride. I shook my head in dismay, as though I carried the disgust of all society. The police had blinders on, like those blinders put on horses so they stay on track. The police were on a track that led to Lisa Trammell, and they would look at nothing else. Lisa Trammell, Lisa Trammell, Lisa Trammell. Well, what about Aloft and the tens of millions of dollars that Mitchell Bondurant was threatening? Nope, not interested. Lisa Trammell, Lisa Trammell, Lisa Trammell. The train was on the track, and they rode it home. I paused and paced in front of the jury. For the first time, I looked about the courtroom. It was filled to capacity, with even some people standing in the back. I saw Maggie McPherson standing back there, and next to her was my daughter. I froze in mid-step, but then quickly recovered. It made my heart feel good as I turned back to the jury and brought my case to an end. But you see what they didn't see or refused to see. You see that they got on the wrong track. You see that they were cleverly manipulated. You see the truth. I gestured to the mannequin. The physical evidence doesn't work. The circumstantial evidence doesn't work. The case doesn't bear scrutiny in the light of day. The only thing this case adds up to is reasonable doubt. Common sense tells you this. Your instincts tell you this. I urge you to set Lisa Trammell free. Let her go. It is the right thing to do. I said thank you and returned to my seat, patting Manny on the shoulder as I passed. As we had previously planned, Lisa Trammell grabbed and squeezed my arm once I sat down. She mouthed the words, "Thank you," for all on the jury to see. I checked my watch under the defense table and saw I had only taken 25 minutes. I started to settle in for the second part of the state's closer when Freeman asked the judge to have me remove the mannequin from the courtroom. The judge told me to do so, and I got back up. I carried the mannequin to the gate, where I was met by Cisco, who had been in the audience. "I got it, boss," he whispered. "I'll take him outside." "Thanks." "You did good." "Thanks. Freeman moved to the well to deliver the second part of her summation. She wasted no time in attacking the contentions of the defense.
I don't need any props to try to mislead you. I don't need any conspiracies or unnamed or unknown killers. I have the facts and the evidence that prove well beyond any reasonable doubt that Lisa Trammell murdered Mitchell Bondurant.
And it went from there. Freeman used her entire allotment of time, hammering the defense case while bolstering the evidence the state had shown. It was a fairly routine Joe Friday closing, just the facts, or the supposed facts, delivered like a steady drumbeat. Not bad, but not all that good either. I saw the attention of some of the jurors wandering through parts of it, which could be taken two ways. One, they weren't buying it, or two, they had already bought it and didn't need to hear it again. Freeman steadily amped it up until her big finish, a standard summing of the power and might of the state to cast judgment and exact justice. The facts of this case are unalterable. The facts do not lie. The evidence clearly shows that the defendant waited behind the pillar in the garage for Mitchell Bondurant. The evidence clearly shows that when he stepped out of his car, the defendant attacked. It was his blood on her hammer and his blood on her shoe. These are facts, ladies and gentlemen. These are undisputed facts. These are the building blocks of evidence. Evidence that proves beyond a reasonable doubt that Lisa Trammell killed Mitchell Bondurant. That she came up behind him and brutally struck him with her hammer. That she even hit him again and again after he was down and dead. We don't know exactly what position he was in or she was in. She is the only one who knows that. But we do know that she did it. The evidence in this case points to one person. And of course, Freeman had to point the finger at my client. Her, Lisa Trammell. She did it, and now through the tricks of her attorney, she asks you to let her go. Don't do it. Give Mitchell Bondurant justice. Find his killer guilty of this crime. Thank you. Freeman took her seat. I gave her closing a B, but I had already awarded myself an A, egotist that I am. Still, usually all it took was a C for the prosecution to triumph. It's always a stacked deck for the state, and often the defense attorney's very best work is simply not good enough to overcome the power and the might. Judge Perry moved directly into the jury charge, reading his final instructions to them. These were not only the rules of deliberations, but also instructions specific to the case. He gave great attention to Louis Aparicio and warned again that his testimony was not to be considered during the deliberations. The charge ended up being nearly as long as my closing, but finally, just after three, the judge sent the 12 jurors back to the assembly room to begin their task. As I watched them file through the door, I was at least relaxed, if not confident. I had put the best case forward that I could. I had certainly bent some rules and pushed some boundaries. I had even put myself at risk. At risk based on the law, but also something more dangerous. I had risked myself by believing in the possibility of my client's innocence. I looked over at Lisa as the door to the deliberations room closed. I saw no fear in her eyes, and once again I bought in. She was already sure of the verdict. There wasn't a doubt on her face. "What do you think?" Aronson whispered to me. "I think we've got a 50-50 shot at this, and that's better than we usually get. Especially on a murder. We'll see." The judge recessed court after making sure the clerk had contact numbers for all parties and urging us to stay somewhere no more than 15 minutes away should a verdict come in. My office was in that range, so we decided to head back there. Feeling optimistic and magnanimous, I even told Lisa she could invite Herb Dahl along. I felt it would be my obligation to eventually inform her of her guardian angel's treachery, but that conversation would be saved for another day. As the defense party walked out into the hallway, the media started to gather around us, clamoring for a statement from Lisa or at least me. Behind the crowd, I saw Maggie leaning against a wall, my daughter sitting on a bench next to her while texting away on her phone. I told Aronson to handle the reporters, and I started to slip away.
Me?
Aronson said. You know what to say. Just don't let Lisa talk. Not till we have a verdict. I waved off a couple of trailing reporters and got to Maggie and Haley. I made a quick feint one way and then went the other, kissing my daughter on the cheek before she could duck away.
Dad!
I straightened up and looked at Maggie. She had a small smile on her face.
You pulled her out of school for me?
I thought she should be here. It was a major concession.
Thank you, I said.
So what did you think?
I think you could sell ice in Antarctica, she said.
I smiled.
But that doesn't mean you're going to win, she added.
I frowned.
Thanks a lot.
Well, what do you want from me? I'm a prosecutor. I don't like to see the guilty go free.
Well, that won't be a problem in this case.
I guess you have to believe what you have to believe.
I was back to smiling. I checked my daughter and saw she was back to texting, oblivious to our conversation as usual.
Did Freeman talk to you yesterday?
You mean about you pulling the fifth witness move?
Yes. You don't play fair, Holler.
It's not a fair game.
Did she tell you what she said to me after?
No. What did she say?
Never mind. She was wrong.
She knitted her eyebrows. She was intrigued.
I'll tell you later, I said. We're all going to walk over to my office to wait. You two want to come?
No, I think I need to get Haley home. She's got homework.
My phone buzzed in my pocket. I pulled it and took a look. The screen said L.A. Superior Court. I took the call. It was Judge Perry's clerk. I listened and then hung up. I looked around to make sure Lisa Trammell was still nearby.
What is it? Maggie asked.
I looked back at her. We already have a verdict. A 5-minute verdict.
Part 5. The Hypocrisy of Innocence. Chapter 53. They came in droves, pouring in from all over Southern California, all brought by the siren song of Facebook. Lisa Trammell had announced the party the morning after the verdict, and now, on Saturday afternoon, they were 10 deep at the cash bars. They waved the stars and stripes and wore red, white, and blue. Fighting foreclosure with the nearly martyred leader of the cause was now more American than ever before. At every door to the house and spaced at intervals in the front and backyards were 10-gallon buckets for donations to defray Trammell's expenses and keep the fight going. Flag pins for $1, cheap cotton t-shirts for $10, and posing with Lisa for a photo required a minimum $20 donation. But nobody complained. Fired in the kiln of false accusation, Lisa Trammell had emerged unscathed and appeared to be about to make the jump from activist to icon, and she wasn't unhappy about it. The rumor was that Julia Roberts was in talks to play the part in the movie. My crew and I were stationed in the backyard at a picnic table with an umbrella. We had come early and gotten the spot. Cisco and Lorna were drinking canned beer, and Aronson and I were on bottled water. There was a slight tension at the table, and I picked up enough innuendo to understand that it had something to do with how late Cisco had stayed at Four Green Fields with Aronson back on Monday night after I'd left with Maggie McPherce.
"Geez, look at all of these people," Lorna said. "Don't they know that a not guilty verdict doesn't mean she's innocent?"
"That's bad etiquette, Lorna," I said. "You're never supposed to say that, especially when it's your own client you're talking about."
"I know."
She frowned and shook her head.
"You're not a believer, Lorna?"
"Well, don't tell me you are."
I was glad I was wearing sunglasses. I didn't want to reveal myself on this one. I shrugged like I didn't know, or it didn't matter.
But it did. You have to live with yourself. Knowing that there was a solid chance that Lisa Trammell actually deserved the verdict she got made things a whole lot better when I looked in the mirror.
"Well, I'll tell you one thing," Lorna said. "Our phone hasn't stopped ringing since the verdict came in. We're back in business big time."
Sisko nodded approvingly. It was true. It seemed as though every accused criminal in the city wanted to hire me now. This would have been great if I had wanted things to continue the way they were going.
"Did you check out the closing price on Lemur yesterday on NASDAQ?" Sisko asked.
I gave him a look.
"You following the street now?"
"Just wanted to see if anybody was paying attention, and it looks like they were. Lemur dropped 30% of its value in 2 days. Didn't help that the Wall Street Journal ran a story connecting Aparicio to Joey Giordano and questioning how much of that $61 million he got went into the mob's pocket."
"Probably all of it," Lorna said. "So, Mickey," Aronson said, "how'd you know?"
"Know what?"
"That Aparicio would take the nickel."
I shrugged again. "I didn't. I just figured that once it became apparent that his connections were going to come out in open court, he would do what he had to do to stop it. He had one choice, the fifth." Aronson didn't look as though my answer appeased her. I turned away and looked across the crowded yard. My client's son was at a nearby table with her sister. They both looked bored, as if forced to be there. A large group of children had gathered near the terraced herb garden. A woman in the middle of the circle was handing out candy from a bag. She was wearing a red, white, and blue top hat like Uncle Sam's.
"How long do we need to stay, boss?" Sisko asked.
"You're not on the clock," I said. "I just thought we should put in an appearance."
"I want to stay," Lorna said, probably just to spite him. "Maybe some Hollywood people will show up."
A few minutes later, the main attraction of the day came out the back door, followed by a reporter and a cameraman. They picked a location with the crowd in the background, and Lisa Trammell stood for a quick interview. I didn't bother to try to listen. I'd heard and seen the same interview enough over the past 2 days. After Lisa finished the interview, she broke away from the media, shook some hands, and posed for some photos. Eventually, she made her way to our table, stopping to ruffle her son's hair on the way.
"There they are, the victors. How's my team doing today?"
I managed to smile. "We're good, Lisa. And you look good, too. Where's Herb?" She looked around, as if looking for Dahl in the crowd.
"I don't know. He was supposed to be here."
"Too bad," Sisko said. "We'll miss him."
Lisa didn't seem to register the sarcasm.
"You know, I need to talk to you later, Mickey," she said. "I need your advice on which show to do, Good Morning America or Today. They both want me next week, but I have to pick one because neither will take seconds."
I flipped my hand as if the answer didn't matter. "I don't know. Herb can probably help you with that. He's the media guy." Lisa looked back at the gathering of children and started to smile.
"Oh, I have just the thing for those children. Excuse me, everybody."
She hurried off and went around the corner of the house.
"She's sure loving it, isn't she?" Sisko said.
"I would be too,"
Lorna said. I looked at Aronson. "Why so quiet?" She shrugged.
"I don't know. I'm not so sure I like criminal defense anymore. I think if you take on some of those people who have been calling, I'll stick with the foreclosures, if you don't mind."
I nodded. "I think I know what you're feeling. You can do the foreclosure work if you want to. There's going to be plenty of that for a while, especially with guys like Aparicio still in business. But that feeling you've got does go away. Believe me, Bullocks, it does." She didn't respond to the return of her nickname or anything else I had said. I turned to look across the yard. Lisa was back, and she had rolled out the helium tank from the garage. She told the children to gather around and started filling balloons. The TV cameraman moved in to get the shot. It would be perfect for the 6 o'clock news.
"Now, is she doing that for the kids or for the camera?" Sisko asked.
"You really have to ask?" Lorna responded.
Lisa pulled a blue balloon off the tank and expertly tied it off with a string. She handed it to a girl of about 6, who grabbed the string and let the balloon shoot 6 feet above her head. The girl smiled and turned her face up to gaze at her new toy. And in that moment, I knew what Mitchell Bondurant was looking up at when Lisa hit him with the hammer. "She did it," I whispered under my breath. I felt the burn of a million synapses firing down my neck and across my shoulders.
"What did you say?"
Aronson asked me. I looked at her, but didn't answer, and then looked back at my client. She filled another balloon with gas, tied the knot, and handed it to a boy. The same thing happened again. The boy held the string and turned his cheery face up to look at the red balloon. An instinctive, natural response. To look up at the balloon.
"Oh my God," Aronson said.
She had put it together too.
"That's how she did it."
Now Sisko and Lorna had turned.
"The witness said she was carrying a big shopping bag on the sidewalk," Aronson said. "Big enough to hold a hammer, yes. But also big enough to hold balloons."
I took it from there. She sneaks into the garage and puts the balloons up over Bondurant's parking space. Maybe there's a note on the end of each string, so he's sure to see them. "Yeah," Sisko said. "Like, here's your balloon payment." "She hides behind the pillar and waits," I said. "And when Bondurant looks up at the balloons," Sisko concluded, "bang, right on the back of the head." I nodded. And the two pops somebody thought were gunshots, but were dismissed as backfire, were neither, I said. "She popped the balloons on the way out." A dreadful silence fell over the table, until Lorna spoke.
"Wait a minute. You're saying she planned it that way? Like she knew if she hit him on the top of the head it would throw the jury?"
I shook my head. "No, that was just luck. She just wanted to stop him. She used the balloons to make sure he paused and she could come up behind him. The rest was just dumb luck. Something that a defense lawyer knew how to use." I couldn't look at my colleagues. I stared off at Lisa filling balloons.
"So, we helped her get away with it."
It was a statement from Lorna, not a question.
"Double jeopardy," Aronson said. "She can never be tried again."
As if on cue, Lisa looked over at us while she tied off the end of a white balloon. She handed it to another child, and she smiled at me. "Sisko, how much are they charging for the beer?" $5 a can. It's a ripoff."
"Mickey, don't," Lorna said. "It's not worth it. You've been so good."
I pulled my eyes away from my client and looked at Lorna. "Good? Are you saying I'm one of the good guys?" I got up and left them there and headed toward the backyard bar, where I took my place in line. I expected Lorna to follow me, but it was Aronson who came up next to me. She spoke in a very low voice.
"Look, what are you doing? You told me not to grow a conscience. Are you telling me you did?"
"I don't know," I whispered. "All I know is that she played me like a fucking fiddle, and you know what? She knows I know. She just gave me that smile. I saw it in her eyes. She's proud of it. She pulled the tank into the yard so I would see it, and I would know." I shook my head. "She had me wired from day one. Everything was part of her plan. Every last..." I stopped as I realized something.
"What?"
Aronson asked. I paused as I continued to put it together.
"What, Mickey?"
"Her husband wasn't even her husband."
"What do you mean?"
"The guy calling me, the guy who showed up. Where is he now for the big payday? He's not here because that wasn't him. He was just part of the play."
"Then where is the husband?"
That was the question. But I had no answer. I didn't have any answers anymore. "I'm leaving." I stepped out of the line and headed toward the back door. Mickey, where are you going?
I didn't answer. I quickly passed through the house and out the front door. I had arrived early enough to catch a curb slot only two houses down. I was almost to the Lincoln when I heard my name called from behind. It was Lisa. She was walking toward me in the street.
Mickey, you're leaving?
Yes, I'm leaving.
Why? The party's just starting.
She came up close to me and stopped. I'm leaving because I know, Lisa. I know.
What do you think you know?
That you used me like you use everybody, even Herb Dahl.
Oh, come on. You're a defense lawyer. You'll get more business out of this than you've ever had before.
Just like that, she acknowledged everything. What if I didn't want the business? What if I just wanted to believe something was true? She paused. She didn't get it.
Get over yourself, Mickey. Wake up.
I nodded. It was good advice.
Who was he, Lisa?
I asked.
Who is who?
The guy you sent me, who said he was your husband. Now, a small, proud smile curled her bottom lip.
Goodbye, Mickey. Thank you for everything.
She turned and started walking back toward her house, and I got in my Lincoln and drove away. Chapter 54. I was in the back seat of the Lincoln, cruising through the 3rd Street tunnel, when my phone started to buzz. The screen said it was Maggie. I told Rojas to kill the music, it was Clapton's latest, and took the call.
Did you do it?
She asked first thing. I looked out the window as we broke clear of the tunnel and into the bright sunlight. It fit with the way I was feeling. It had been 3 weeks since the verdict, and the further I got away from it, the better I felt. I was on the road to something else now.
I did. Wow. Congratulations.
I'm still the longest long shot you'll ever see. The field is full, and I've got no money.
Doesn't matter. You're a name in this town, and there's a certain integrity about you that people see and respond to. I know I did. Plus, you're an outsider. Outsiders always win. So don't kid yourself. The money will come.
I wasn't sure integrity and me belonged in the same sentence. But I'd take the rest. And besides, it was the happiest I'd heard Maggie McPherson in a long, long time. Well, we'll see, I said. But as long as I have your vote, I don't care if I get another.
That's sweet, Holler. What's next?
Good question. I have to go open a bank account and assemble a... My phone started beeping. I had another call coming in. I checked the screen and saw that it was blocked.
Mags, hold on a second. Let me just check this call. Go ahead.
I switched over. This is Michael Holler.
You did this.
I recognized the angry voice. Lisa Trammell. Did what?
The police are here. They're digging up the garden looking for him. You sent them.
I assumed the him she referred to was her missing husband, who never quite made it to Mexico. Her voice had the familiar shrill tone it took on when she was on the edge of losing it. Lisa,
I need you here. I need a lawyer. They're going to arrest me.
Meaning that she knew what the police would find in the garden. Lisa, I'm not your lawyer anymore. I can recommend a...
No! You can't abandon me! Not now!
Lisa, you just accused me of sending the cops. Now you want me to represent you?
I need you, Mickey. Please.
She started crying. That long, echoing sob I had heard too many times before. Get somebody else, Lisa. I'm done. With any luck, I might even get to prosecute you.
What are you talking about?
I just filed. I'm running for district attorney.
I don't understand.
I'm changing my life. I'm tired of being around people like you. There was no response at first, but I could hear her breathing. When she finally spoke, her voice had a flat, emotionless tone to it.
I should have told Herb to have them maim you. That's what you deserve.
Now I was silent. I knew what she was talking about. The Mack brothers.
Dahl had lied to me and said Aparicio had ordered the beating. But that didn't fit with the rest of the story. This did. It had been Lisa who wanted it done. She was willing to have her own attorney attacked if it would deflect suspicion and help her case. If it would help me believe in other possibilities. I managed to find my voice and say my final words to her. Goodbye, Lisa, and good luck. I composed myself and switched back over to my ex-wife. Sorry, it was a client, a former client.
Everything all right?
I leaned against the window. Rojas was just turning on Alvarado and heading to the 101. I'm good. So you want to go somewhere tonight and talk about the campaign?
You know, while I was on hold, I was thinking, why don't you come to my place? We can eat with Haley and then talk while she does her homework.
It was a rare invite to her home. So a guy has to run for DA to get invited over to your place?
Don't press your luck, Holler.
I won't. What time?
6.
See you then. I disconnected and stared out the window for a little while.
Mr. Holler?
Rojas asked.
You run for DA?
Yeah. You have a problem with that, Rojas?
No, boss. But do you still need a driver?
Sure, Rojas. Your job is safe. I called the office, and Lorna answered. Where is everybody?
They're here. Jennifer is using your office for a new client interview, a foreclosure. And Dennis is doing something on the computer. Where have you been?
Downtown, but I'm heading back. Make sure nobody leaves. I want to have a staff meeting.
Okay, I'll tell them.
Good. See you in about 30. I closed the phone. We were coming up the ramp onto the 101. All 6 lanes were clogged with metal, moving at a steady but slow pace. I wouldn't have had it any other way. This was my city, and this was the way it was supposed to run. At Rojas's command, the black Lincoln cut through the lanes and around the traffic, carrying me toward a new destiny. Acknowledgements. The author wishes to thank several people for their help during the writing of this novel. They include Asya Muchnick, Bill Massey, Terrill Lee Lankford, Jane Davis, and Heather Rizzo. Special thanks also go to Susanna Brom, Daniel Daly, Roger Mills, Jay Stein, Rick Jackson, Tim Marcia, Mike Roche, Greg Stout, John Houghton, Dennis Wojciechowski, Charles Hounshell, and last but not least, Linda Connolly. This is a novel. Any errors of fact, geography, or legal canon and procedure are purely the fault of the author.
This has been an Hachette audio production of The Fifth Witness by Michael Connolly. Read by Peter Giles. Executive producer, Michelle McGonigal. Produced and directed by Linda Korn. Recorded by Wes Dewberry at The Invisible Studios. Post-production by Dion Audio. The Fifth Witness is also available in print and as an ebook from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2011 by Hieronymus Inc. Audio production copyright 2011, Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this publication may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the written permission of the publisher. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.
Hello, this is Linda Korn, and I'm speaking with Michael Connolly, best-selling author of The Fifth Witness, the latest in his Mickey Holler series. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
In the Fifth Witness, Holler, in tough economic times, has been standing up for the many victims of foreclosure. Did you feel a particular sensitivity towards this aspect of the recent economic crisis?
I think the reason that I went into this form of the law, foreclosure defense, was really because one of the attorneys who has inspired Mickey Holler and has helped me since the beginning has gone into this direction himself. So I'm really kind of piggybacking on his own experience. And what I found was that in the economic downturn, there's not a lot of paying clients for criminal defense. And so this attorney had to find another way of making a living. And so he kind of did some retraining and started pursuing foreclosure defense, because within the law, it's really the only growth industry. And so watching him in work and spending a lot of time interviewing him, that kind of led to the sensitivity of this issue. And there's a line that hopefully is discussed or looked at in the book of whether these people are victims, are they underdogs of society, or are they people gaming the system? You know, it's an individual thing and you can make arguments either way. And hopefully that is covered in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so current that you really capture the time and then get into this incredibly creative crime that takes place. So I'm wondering who or what inspired the character of this woman, Lisa Trammell, accused of murdering the bank officer.
Well, I guess there's not a real inspiration for Lisa Trammell in this book. It's just part of my continuing efforts to be accurate, to kind of bring a realism to my books. The attorneys that I deal with in terms of research for these stories have often told me that the relationships with their clients are not always good. Especially when you're in the world of criminal defense, you often deal with people who have various levels of behavioral issues and psychological issues. So I was just looking for a way of bringing that into the story, and that would further cloud the question of did she do it or did she not do it. I mean, just because someone has a disagreeable personality doesn't necessarily mean they're guilty of a crime. And so I just kind of throw these things in there to make it a little bit harder to figure it out for the reader or listener.
It was interesting to me that you chose a woman to be in this position, and it was very interesting that she ended up being separated and left with this house. Was that based on a real event, or did you specifically choose that scenario?
The scenario with the defendant being a woman coming into this through a foreclosure case is purely fictional. I'm kind of in a box. I found that you kind of get hemmed in when you're doing a series involving a criminal defense attorney, you know, because there's only so many different themes you can have to a crime. Did they do it? Did they not do it? Did they get away with it? Those kind of things. And I've written three other stories featuring Mickey Holler, and in each of those, the defendant was male. So it was purely a question of, like, try something new, try to get into a character of a female. I've done that in the past in other books unrelated to Mickey Holler. So I just felt instinctively that it was time to go in that direction. But Lisa's not really based on any real case that I came across in the research.
Mickey Holler, Bosch, Lisa Trammell. Nobody has too many happy marriages in the book.
You know, that is a repetitive theme in my books, I guess. And it's not necessarily a theme about marriage. It's more a theme about happiness and pursuit of happiness and searching, looking for something. I think it's leaning against a crutch, but it's certainly easier to draw characters that have a missing part and are looking for it, who have that, you know, at the end of the day, when they come home to an empty house, or they come home to a difficult relationship. It certainly makes, I think, the drama of the fiction a lot easier to draw, and maybe that's why I've fallen into that. You know, I think, though, hopefully, Mickey's moving towards some happiness. He makes some progress in this book of trying to restore his family. You know, there's a setup towards the end of the book for the next story where hopefully that will be in place.
When you began this series with, I think, the Lincoln Lawyer, right?
Yes.
Did you know where Mickey Holler was headed, or has he really evolved with the times?
He definitely has evolved, I think, over time. I don't really put too much planning into the, you know, of what's going on with him in the future. Cause, you know, this book hopefully is seen as very contemporary. You know, the idea of, him working in foreclosure defense. So there's no way, I think, 4 or 5 years ago, actually it was 6 years ago now, when I wrote, The Lincoln Lawyer, that I could foresee this. And that's what usually happens to me with my books. I hold back, don't plan too much of the future. I just know that I like this character and I want to come back to him. I'm trying to keep this character alive, and the best way to keep the character alive is to have them change all the time. And you can't just change cases. You have to change your character. Character has to evolve. And so this is the fourth time I've written about Mickey Haller. And so I just felt it was time to go into a new direction. And so the end of the book does have a big setup for what could possibly be that new direction. As I said before, I don't plan a whole lot about the future till it's time to write this story. But I certainly set something up in this book that I can grab onto next time I feel it's time to write about Mickey.
Right, and we'll certainly be looking forward to that time. Just to discuss, there is a movie being made of The Lincoln Lawyer, is that right?
Yeah, it's already made.
And have you been much involved with that?
Well, I was involved in that. I wrote the book it was based on, but after that, I was not too involved. They were very cordial and welcoming to me. I was allowed to go to the set whenever I wanted. I watched a lot of it get made. I've already seen a screening of the film, and I'm very happy with it. They did a really good job. Matthew McConaughey plays Mickey Haller, and when I wrote the book, I didn't picture him. But once he started playing him, I just thought he nailed him. He nailed it. He just really has the... I don't know how to put it into words, but basically he's a guy who's looking at all the angles. He's looking for an angle, and that's what Mickey does. And I think Matthew portrays that with just his eyes alone in this film. So I think he did a really good job, and the whole film I was pretty happy with.
Well, congratulations on that. It's going to be very exciting. And I'm wondering if there's anything you'd like to say to your audiobook fans out there.
I just want to say that I really appreciate the support of my work in any form, you know, whether you're reading or listening. It's storytelling, and I get a lot of responses from people who listen to the books, and it's very fulfilling. I just hope it continues and people continue to enjoy my stuff.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us, Michael, and we certainly look forward to all that's to come next.
Thank you very much, Linda.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.